Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Greg Brockman to the broadcast. Greg is co-founder and CTO at OpenAI, a nonprofit artificial intelligence research company that also includes Elon Musk, Sam Altman of Y Combinator, and other Silicon Valley luminaries as co-founders. OpenAI was founded to ensure that artificial intelligence benefits humanity as a whole. Prior to OpenAI, Greg was the CTO of Stripe, a fintech company that builds tools enabling web commerce. Greg was the fourth employee at Stripe, which is a company that is now valued at over $5 billion. Greg studied mathematics and computer science at Harvard University and computer science at MIT, though he left to work on Stripe before graduating. I recently caught up with Greg at a coffee shop near his office in San Francisco, and you'll hear some background noise from the venue throughout the conversation. Our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, people, as we discussed how the organization's bold mission and unique structure acts as a magnet for world-class talent. Principle 2, infrastructure, as we discussed the technical details of what OpenAI is working on. We also covered how structuring OpenAI as a nonprofit helps maximize its benefit, the trend of open sourcing AI development, how AI may impact jobs and society more generally speaking, the promise versus the peril of AI, and a variety of other topics. This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much. Greg Brockman, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT. All
right, thank you for having me.
Excellent. So, Greg, I thought we'd begin with your organization, OpenAI. The stated goal of the organization on your site is to advance digital intelligence in the way that is most likely to benefit humanity as a whole, unconstrained by a need to generate financial return, as I'm sure you're familiar. And I thought we'd sort of expand on a couple different aspects of that. Number one, First, what advances in digital intelligence are most likely to benefit humanity as a whole in your mind?
Yep. OpenAI, I think, is a really interesting organization, and the organization really came together started coming together in the summer of last year, and that there had been a bunch of conversations happening between a number of people who ended up being involved. So between Sam and Elon, Sam and me, and all of us and Ilya, and I think that there's something very special going on right now in the field of artificial intelligence, where for the first time that we've started to see these systems that are based on deep learning and statistical methods suddenly start to have extremely good performance, and that you're able to start building computer vision systems, for example, that can classify objects in a certain sense much better than humans can, right? And that we're starting to see these systems that rather than having humans go and spend a bunch of time going and really thinking hard about a problem and understanding how do I write down the code to specifically solve this problem, instead you build this general architecture, and the architecture learns from the data. And so what we're getting better and better at is writing these algorithms that are able to learn and able to understand the world and able to operate within it. And at the same time, as we start to get these new capabilities, I don't think that the world has changed in a significant way as a result yet. And it's really only been a very short period of time where these algorithms started to be best in class. This really dates back to about 2012, when there was a particular paper that just showed that, hey, if you just take this neural network architecture and sort of scale it up in the right way and have some clever performance, that you're going to be able to just perform way better on this series of object recognition tasks, on these image tasks. And people since then have started to apply similar techniques in a variety of different areas and started to see, wow, this really works in a broad variety of domains. And so I think that what we're going to see is that we're going to see these techniques that people have been developing over the past couple of years really mature and start to be baked into a wide variety of products, both at big companies and at new companies and a variety of different applications. And so I think that what you're going to start seeing is you're going to start seeing the world changing quite a lot as a result of advances in artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to some extent, you know, we're already starting to get a sense of this. If you think about self-driving cars, you know, they're basically here. There's a lot of engineering left to do, and there's a lot of hard work and a lot of societal questions to answer.
The regulations and so forth, yep.
Absolutely. But there's not a question of whether it's possible anymore. It's just a question of when. It's not a question of if. And I think that's the tip of the iceberg. I think we're going to start seeing a bunch of other applications like that. For example, robotics, I think, is really poised to start working. And I imagine if you have a robot in your house that can go and kind of clean things, or, you know, maybe go and you know, zap ants, or, you know, whatever it is that people end up deciding to do here. And again, this is something that a couple of years ago, I think it wasn't clear. I think it wasn't something that was really on the horizon. And now we're really at this tipping point where some of these things, it's not even extrapolation anymore to say that it's going to start working and it's going to start having an impact. And so to step back and say, you know, what is OpenAI doing? What's the impact that we're looking for artificial intelligence, the benefit we think that it can have? It's really about this, that we see that artificial intelligence in the short term is something that is going to have a very large impact. And I think that there's a decent chance that it's going to be the defining technology of the next 10 years. But also in the long term, if you think about where all this can go, you know, at some point it looks like we're going to be able to build, say, to real human-level intelligence, right? And I think that that's been sort of the pipe dream for a very long time. Mm-hmm. But it seems like, you know, over time we're getting systems that are more and more capable on more and more axes. And at some point, you're just going to have something that's very capable on a wide variety of axes. And what happens then? And I don't think anyone has a good answer for it yet. Mm-hmm. And so from the perspective of this organization, that we view our goal as, let's go and advance the state of the art in a way that is positive and ensure that it's something that is good for the world. And I think that in the short term, a lot of that is about just advancing the capabilities and ensuring that everyone has access to those. So, you know, we're not going to be patenting our work. We're going to make sure that the work is something that is accessible and available to the world. And in the long term, think about the question of how do we make sure that this all just happens and unfolds in the best possible way. And I think that one very important thing structurally is, so we're a nonprofit. We're not operating for a financial return. Mm-hmm. That we
sort of long-term science is really what your focus is.
Absolutely, yeah. And that we've really gone and removed the traditional constraints so that we can just focus on this one singular goal of just do the best thing. And what that best thing is, I think you have to be adaptive. I think you can't hope to know. What does a world look like, even again, back to just the short-term questions of what does the world look like once you have self-driving cars and once you have home robots and once you have this other long list of things that we're going to have, adaptive systems that understand a lot more about what we're doing. Imagine once you have creative assistants that as you're typing an essay, that they kind of understand what you're doing and give you some feedback of, oh, it looks like your paragraph here was unclear, or, you know, I generated this idea for you, or go and do some research for you. And again, these aren't things that we can build today. They're not things that we have good answers for right now, but they're not a million miles from the kinds of things that we can do. And so I think that it's going to be an ongoing question, ongoing debate in society for what's the best way for these things to unfold, how do we make sure that it's positive? And we know that there are trade-offs, right? You think about job displacement. That's a very obvious trade-off that's coming right now. Yep. And as time goes on, there's going to be a lot of questions around surveillance and around the way that these technologies are applied by humans. And I think in the long term, there's going to be a question of what are the emergent effects, right? You know, if you really have a very capable system, you know, how do you make sure that it's acting in a way that's good for the world and something that any human wants? Mm-hmm. And I think that all these questions need to be answered. And I think that it's not, I think it's not necessarily the case that we want OpenAI to be the one to answer all those questions, mm-hmm. but we want to help. And we want to be an organization that is very clear that we are focused on one thing, which is the benefit for humanity. And let's make sure that all of the actions that we take are the thing that we think will maximize that.
And to what extent do you see your role also as one of influence for for-profit organizations and others who are, you know, have similar goals, but obviously have a different financial, you know, return as part of their goal as well?
Yeah, I think that we are going to end up working with quite a lot of different entities, and I think that's a really good and positive thing. I view us as a neutral entity that can sort of work with a bunch of these organizations and really hope to help form a coalition of different groups that are working towards a similar goal in the end. And I think that, you know, it's very much the case that today there are other organizations out there that I think do a very good job of being open and collaborating. I mean, there's obviously universities, but also if you look at the industrial labs, that they're all, for the most part, they're all publishing, right? That there are probably a few exceptions that have really good people who, you know, that for whatever reason there are barriers to them getting their work out. But I think that there's no question that if you look at the majority of the labs out there, that there is this really nice ethos. And so I think that to some extent I view us joining this community that's really been forming, and that I hope for us in the long term to help preserve that and help grow that and help increase the influence that has on the world.
Yeah. And how, so you've spoken, I think, in equal measure about the opportunity that AI represents, but also some of the issues that need to be resolved or at least contemplated as AI advances.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the grand scheme of things, where are you sort of in the balance between optimism and cynicism about this? I mean, I sense you are very optimistic. I'm sure it's much more balanced towards that, but you also have equal measure sort of caution as well. And I think it seems to be at the heart of the foundation of OpenAI also. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so I view myself as an optimistic realist.
Okay.
And I think that it's always important to think about both the what's the best possible way for a new technology or a new company or new organization to unfold? You know, what's the maximum possible impact that you could hope for? And then you really have to think through how do you get there, right? And that you really have to confront the brutal facts of reality, right? And the questions of, you know, for starting anything new, that there's always going to be challenges. For any new technology, there are always going to be potential misuses. And you know, for some technologies, that there are these externalities that you really have to worry about that no human wants. For example, global warming is a perfect example, right? That I really wish that 50 years ago someone had spent some time thinking about where's this all going to go, right? You know, as we keep burning all these fossil fuels, what's that going to look like? And the people had started to invest a little bit more in renewable energy earlier, or just thinking about what the long-term impacts would be. And so I would say that I think that artificial intelligence is the technology that I know that is most likely to has the most potential to be a transformative, positive influence in the world. I think that if you really solve artificial intelligence, that you can increase, you can improve the lives of basically everyone in really fundamental ways. And I think that there, I think that that's a huge opportunity, right? That's a really wonderful statement, and I think that it would be a shame for us to squander it as a society.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, obviously, you come from the private sector. You were the CTO of Stripe prior to this. To what extent does that experience color your perspective here? You've been as a part of a for-profit organization and a successful one at that. And I'm just curious, sort of now going from for-profit to non-profit, your emphasis, as I've read and as we just spoke about, of trying to reverse the typical mentality of short-term financial gain for long-term science and advancement. I'm curious how one impacted or influenced the other in your mind.
Yeah, so OpenAI is a very different kind of organization in a lot of ways, right? In that normally I think that your goal when you're building any organization is really to focus on impact, right? That if you focus just on profits, then I think that you're just not going to be able to build a successful organization because, you know, at the end of the day, that never is enough, right? That you always have a choice of making a trade-off for short-term profits in exchange for long-term benefits, and I think that if you can't navigate that space very well, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. Your competitors will do a better job than you. And you know, I think of companies that do this very well. I think of like Amazon, right? You know, it's a perfect example of a company that I think is just very focused on the long term and has built a ton of value as a result.
Yeah.
And so I'd say at Stripe, you know, I think that we always thought and continue, you know, from what I know, I think the company, you know, very much operates in the same way. About ourselves as not just, okay, let's build a startup and try to raise some money and try to get some customers, right? But instead to say, we want to make transactions on the internet seamless. We want to be the financial infrastructure of the web. And there are a lot of pieces to this, right? That there are a lot of people in countries that don't have access to good financial infrastructure, and expanding internationally and providing this infrastructure, making it available to them. That was always part of the mission. That was always in scope. And of course, you know, that there are business reasons to do it, and that I think it's hard to sustain it if there aren't. But that's not necessarily where the real drive comes from. And if you think about the most successful companies that exist, I think that basically every single one of them was started out of some drive to change the world and to just, like, you know, sort of have a large impact and do useful things. So I'd actually say that there's not as much of a direct difference between the way that I think about the work that we're doing as with OpenAI as a nonprofit and the kind of work that you would do as a for-profit on the perspective of thinking about the long term and thinking about impact. I say that the big difference is the question of what happens with the things that we actually produce, right? And I think that as a company, when you produce new inventions, when you produce new intellectual property, well, the thing that you almost are sort of obligated to you, certainly the very default and very strong thing that you do is you monetize them, right? That you patent them, that you want to keep those to yourself because you just invested quite a lot in making those happen. You think about any sort of pharmaceutical company, right? That they spend so much money developing all these drugs, and that's why they then have to sell them for the price that they do.
And there are thousands of failures before that success.
There are thousands of failures before that success, absolutely. Yeah. And with OpenAI, I think that we've been put in this very fortunate position where we have the financial resources to be able to just focus on doing the best thing for the world, focusing on developing this technology in the way that seems to be best for humanity, and that we don't have to think about the how do we also bring in a revenue stream that makes this sustainable.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that we won't. There's a decent chance that at some point we'll say, you know what, let's make this self-sustaining, let's build a product. But again, that should all be subject to the question of what do we think will most advance the cause, what do we think will help with the research, will make us sustainable in the long run, and really help us have the kind of impact that we want in the world.
Yeah. And what kind of team have you put together? I know that one of the reasons why it's been written it took a little while to ramp up OpenAI was that you were trying to build the right team around you. What were you looking for in some of those early folks who you brought aboard?
I'd say that there are a couple of really important factors. And so I'd say every person that we've brought in is truly phenomenal on some very important axis, right? And that sort of at an individual level, that we were really looking for just the kind of people who had done something really amazing, and specifically, the majority of them are researchers in the deep learning field and have done some work that have really changed how people think about a part of the field, or, you know, sort of done something very creative and interesting and really pushed the field forward. And we also have some people who come from an engineering background and have done really amazing things on that axis as well. And I think the most important thing is that you get a group of very smart individuals who have been accomplished and done great things, and still are hungry and still want more and still want to prove themselves and accomplish more and have a large impact, but also a team that is larger than the sum of its parts. And it's really important sort of in these early days, I think, to have a set of people who have a similar research aesthetic, a similar belief about what's important, what are good problems to work on, and a really good chemistry amongst them. And one thing that was actually sort of the moment where I knew we'd gotten it right was we were trying to put together this team and had a lot of conversations going with these individuals, and we brought them all out to a retreat in November. And so we just went off for an offsite for a day and all hung out together and just talked about artificial intelligence and research and some of these ideas. And you could just tell, right, that the ideas were flowing and that there was this energy in the air that was palpable. It was something that you could just feel. And And that was the moment, right, that it just all clicked. And I think that after that, everyone was like, all right, this is going to happen, and this is going to be awesome.
And it's interesting. I mean, there's so much that's written, of course, about – so we're speaking right now in San Francisco, a place where, you know, the center of the universe from a technology perspective in many ways. And so many successful companies, including ones that you've been a part of, obviously are based here and were born here. And a lot of the motivation, it seems one of the reasons why this is such a magnet for talent is the opportunity to be a part of something that's a potential tremendous growth, to, you know, get options in those early stages of an organization, and at a relatively young age have just an extraordinary opportunity to not only have high impact but also significant wealth creation and all these sorts of things. What does it tell you about the incredible team you put together in an organization that does not have those mechanisms as sort of like the long-term hook, if you will, about the motivation to do meaningful work, I suppose, and solve some really tough problems? I'm interested in it since, of course, you're in the milieu, you're drawing from the very people who might choose other kinds of options like the ones I've just described.
Yep. Yeah, and there's no question that I think as AI, I mean, even today, and as AI becomes more and more important, that the sort of number of dollars are going to be flowing into this field is going to be very large. And, you know, I think everyone who's come to OpenAI has given up significant other opportunities elsewhere. And I think that that's something that I think is both very inspiring to me, and I think to the rest of the team, and I think also very important, right, that everyone who's at OpenAI is there because they believe in the mission, because they think that there's going to be huge impact through artificial intelligence, and believe that their research can be better and more impactful at this organization. And I think we've actually already seen this happening, right, that several team members have remarked to me that their ideas in this environment have been better than in any other previous environment, and a lot of that comes back to both the chemistry between the team members and sort of the way the ideas flow and the kind of culture that we're building, but also the sense of urgency, call it, you know, the sense that we're building something that really matters, that we have this impact that we're hoping for, and that we sort of all succeed and fail together. And I think that sense that we need to focus, and it's worth getting out of bed every morning, because if you don't do the stuff that you're working on, no one else is going to, right? That it matters if you try. And so I think the kind of people that we have attracted, and that I see us continuing to attract, are the people who are motivated by that. Sort of this, I think that there's, in research generally, right, that I think that sometimes you have these trade-offs between impact and being able to go and think about ideas. And for machine learning and artificial intelligence, you have this amazing opportunity to have both, right? And sort of the best of both worlds, and something that I think is a really special opportunity. And I think that the kind of people that we're working with and see are people who are motivated by that. How do I sort of think about new ideas and also have an impact through them? And I think that's been really amazing to watch.
Yeah. Describe your role as CTO.
So I view that the primary directive for me is removing all of the all the bullshit, so that everyone else can just focus on doing research. Mm-hmm. Sort of day really consists of a wide variety of quite a lot of recruiting, a lot of organizational vision and strategy, a lot of just sort of digging into various pieces of code and kind of, you know, helping people with making sure we're heading in the right direction, and taking out the trash and, picking up after, you know, whatever's on the floor, whatever it is. And so I think that it's a pretty varied role. But the thing that I think really inspires me is that by doing all of this, that I can allow these really amazing researchers to spend an additional 10% of their time just focused on research and building the right environment that really accelerates what they can do.
Mm-hmm. And what determines the rate at which you're growing people-wise?
So it's really our ability to find and attract great people. So it's purely that. I think that there's...
You would double tomorrow if you could find enough people of the right quality in order to make that work.
I mean, yeah, for sure. If you could find that number of people who were that amazing, like, I think that I don't know what universe we'd be in at that point, right? I think that if only we had such a problem.
Exactly.
I think that this particular field is really interesting because it's sort of been around forever. Like, deep learning is something that has existed for 20 years at least, but at the same time, it's only really started to work way better than everything else in the past couple of years on the set of axes that it does. And so that there are relatively few deep learning experts relative to fields that have been kind of more established for a longer period of time and sort of attracting a larger pool of people. And so it means that there's a relatively small set of people to even be pulling from in the first place. My hope and plan for the organization is to continue to grow on this trajectory that we're on, which is to continue to have the most talent-dense environment and to just be a place where every individual's work is accelerated by everyone around them. And I think that in the next year, I expect that'll be approximately doubling. And I think that longer term, we'll see where that goes.
How many people do you have now?
So we're about 10 people today.
I see. Okay. Yeah. And what role do Elon Musk and Sam Altman play today?
So Sam and Elon are pretty involved. They each is in the office each week, and we get really good advice and help from both of them and the organizations that they're a part of.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And who are other people that are particularly influential to you? Like who, from an AI perspective, who are the people that kind of put you on this path in some ways? Mm-hmm. Who are the people that you read whose thoughts you read and who you kind of follow and whose advice have you sought?
So there's a decent mix of people. So that there are a couple of other advisors to this lab who have been incredibly helpful. Alan Kay is a great one. So Alan was a big force at Xerox PARC in the 1970s, and the Xerox PARC, I'd say, is the organization I most aspire to. I think that they really were able to set the stage for computing for the next 50 years with a small team and just a set of people who worked together really well, had a shared vision for what was important and where to go.
And in some ways, the number of things that they that were born from that, but leveraged by somebody else, although it wasn't intentionally.
It was not intentional.
Yeah. You were actually intentionally open.
Yes,
they were
exactly.
Not. But it's sort of in some ways a similar.
Correct. They had the impact we hoped for, though they would not have hoped for it necessarily.
That's right, since they were for profit.
That's right. Yeah. Although, fun fact is, I think a lot of people think that Xerox didn't make any money off of PARC, but in fact, off the laser printer alone, they made more than their investment.
Right.
And there are a few professors as well who have been really, really helpful. Peter Rabeel, who's a professor at Berkeley, has just been giving truly fantastic advice from day one. And I think that I really appreciate his perspective. There are also some people who are close personal friends who have been really helpful on this journey. And for me, I was always interested in artificial intelligence. One of the first things I coded up was this chatbot system. And so I had written this thing where there was a chatbot, and you could talk to it and kind of learn from the things you were saying to it and that everyone was saying to it. And then I made it so you could have your own personal chatbot, and then I made it so you could do this chatbot battle. And the thing was, like, I had no idea how to actually code any of these algorithms. And as I was looking around, I was like, none of this stuff really works, right? Like, when has anyone ever seen a chatbot that really understands what you're saying to it, right? It can kind of trick you into maybe making you think that it understands, but at the end of the day, it really doesn't. And that was really disappointing for me. And so I started to instead think about other areas where you could have computers really understand what's going on, and programming languages and compilers is a perfect example of that, right? Where you have this program that sort of understands the code that I wrote and writes it in a way that the machine can understand better than I as a human possibly could. And that idea was always very core to me. And from the outside, watching what was happening with deep learning, it wasn't clear whether this was hype or substance, right? Was this something people were just getting excited about and is likely to not really be that important? Or was it something where something had changed and that there were new capabilities being developed? And as I started to dig in, I realized that a lot of my smartest friends from college were now in this field. And I started to talk to some people. For example, Dario Amadai and Chris Ola were two big ones who are both researchers, talking to them about kind of what they've been seeing and what they think. And the more that I dug in, the more that I realized that there are some really awesome people working on this stuff, and that the capabilities are getting really good, and that they're getting to be to the point where, we've had 20 or 30 years worth of computer vision research that worked in a certain way, and now these new techniques are coming in, and you just throw out all the old stuff and replace it with the new stuff. And how far does that stretch? Is it just computer vision? Is it going to be vision and translation and a handful of others, or is it going to be a much wider variety of of computer domains, that remains to be seen. And I think that that's where suddenly it becomes very important to have organizations that are really pushing forward the fundamentals, and rather than just focus on let's improve the performance of the systems that have been built already, instead focus on the fundamentals and say what are the algorithms that don't work yet, but if they worked, that would be awesome, and that they could have some really great things. And I think that just this sort of framework of thinking about the fundamentals and thinking about the way to have a largest impact. I think that actually, I'd say that Sam, who's obviously very involved with this organization, has probably been sort of the number one person that I've kind of talked to about that and gotten very inspired by.
Mm-hmm. What are there other companies you keep an eye on, particularly that you think are doing some really interesting things? And I mean, to what extent you've got like Google's TensorFlow and Facebook's big a Big Sur, Microsoft Computation Network Toolkit, et cetera. They're like AI developments within large companies, and there are also companies that are focused exclusively on it, like the sentient of the world, et cetera. Like, what are some of the organizations that you're kind of keeping your pulse on?
Yeah, I would say that that it's pretty clear that I think that Google and Facebook and Baidu and these other ones that have research labs that have produced really good results, I think that those are really interesting. I think that those are those are really good for the world and have been helping to produce new results and push forward the state of what everyone else can do. And I think that's been a really inspiring thing to watch. And I think that we'll end up collaborating with quite a lot of these people. And I think that if the trends continue, I think that it's really shaping up to be an exciting decade where just these new technologies really come to fruition and I think are going to be something that can be really impactful.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead and go aggressive. I'm also curious, how does it, since you've been in this field for a little while, you've been thinking about it for a while as well, how does it impact your personal life? How do you must see the world maybe a little bit differently than the average bear as a result of thinking about the opportunities of where technology could enhance your experience or replace things that you're doing or replace work that was traditionally done by people and so on? How do you see it sort of impacting your day-to-day life?
I watch a lot more artificial intelligence movies these days. I would say that to some extent, it's interesting that I think it hasn't affected my day-to-day life besides the sort of set of things that I think about, right? That I think that, I'm spending quite a lot of time reading papers and I'm really going deep in this field and quite a lot of time talking to experts, and I think it's something that consumes, 99% of my cycles. But at the same time, I think that that this is the weird contradiction about where the field is right now, is that we have very good capabilities, but I think that day-to-day life hasn't changed yet, right? And that you can kind of look around and you can see all these different places where, if you had, if you took the kind of computer vision we can do now and you applied it here, like, I wonder what you could get done, right? And I think that it's been very interesting to see, for example, companies in the latest Y Combinator batch that are applying deep learning in a variety of domains I would just never have thought about. And I think that they're, from an engineering perspective, it's very interesting to always think about what are the primitives that you have, sort of the tools in your toolbox, and then what can you use them for. And I think that spending some time thinking about that mapping of what are surprising applications, and whether it's if you look at, for example, the kinds of things that Mark Zuckerberg has talked about doing with his Jarvis system that is going to recognize when he comes home and recognize his voice and those sorts of things. I think that that's like a really good way of thinking about the world, right? Is we have these new capabilities, and what surprising things that before just would have been too hard to even imagine. What can we now just do? And so I think that that's maybe the level of it, right? Is like I think that there isn't much you can take off the shelf and go and build your own home gadget that's going to like transform your life. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's going to be true 5 years from now, mm-hmm. right? And so I think that it's interesting to start thinking about, where are we sort of on the edge, right? On the edge of having something that really works and works really well. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it's going to be interesting to see how the answer to that question changes over upcoming years.
Yeah. And do you see do you have any thoughts about commercial, realizing value on a commercial basis, that is, sorry, within the enterprise as opposed to within the consumer space?
I think it's too early to say. And so I think that one thing that's interesting right now is I think that deep learning is very much talent limited, and that they're just, it's kind of like we all just discovered magic, right? And that there are just a very small number of magicians who like know how to manipulate magic. And everyone else is kind of looking at it and is like, huh, that's kind of cool. And like, you know, the larger world, I think, hasn't quite seen it yet. And if you look at, for example, if you look at undergraduate enrollment in various classes, it's very clear that that just enrollment numbers in these deep learning classes has really started to explode. And I mean, really, the deep learning classes have started to exist, right? That's quite new in a lot of institutions. And so I think that there's going to be this whole new generation of people who are going to be trained in these methods and kind of understand how to apply them. But today, there are very few experts, very few people who have been in this field for a very long time. And so right now, that it's something that, you know, Google, for example, I think has been sort of swapping out their pipelines and have taken the old stuff and replaced some of it with the new stuff, and suddenly they get way better performance. But there are still areas that, you know, it's not clear whether or not this is actually going to be the best technique, right? It's not clear whether, you know, the trade-offs that you get are actually going to be worth it. And so I think that even within sort of, you know, particular large companies that really have a bunch of talent and a bunch of expertise and have been doing this for some time, I think even there, it's not clear exactly what the future is going to be, right? And you can read about how Google is now starting to apply deep learning to search, and I think it's still like, you know, I don't know what the future of that's going to look like and how exactly that's going to unfold. And so, you know, I think that you're starting to see some other applications in terms of sort of, you know, some obvious ones in terms of deep learning applied to drones, right? You know, that now you can have drones that can see and kind of understand, you know, what's in front of them, and so you should be able to build drones that can avoid objects and you know, sort of, you know, fly through some you know, complicated environment without bumping into things. And I think that there are going to be some obvious applications in terms of if your Nest was a lot smarter, right? You know, that it just kind of figured out exactly what temperature you want and set it properly. You know, it does a little bit of machine learning right now, but I think that you could imagine where that goes. But I think that that's where we are right now. And I think that the limitation is not necessarily where the technology is applicable, but who is actually applying it and who has the expertise and where are those people and what problems are they thinking about. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's still an open question.
Yeah. What role you mentioned early on the fact that a lot of the applications of AI has the potential, may even already be beginning to have the potential to, or the reality of replacing work. Like, take a particularly good digital assistant. It may do away with actual assistants. And there are a number of jobs, especially lower-paying jobs, that may go away as a result of this. And so from a societal perspective, we need to grapple with what comes next and how do you retrain those people. What role do you see, like, the government playing in helping ensure that as AI advances that it doesn't leave people behind?
Well, so one thing I'll say is that I think that the most successful applications of machine learning and artificial intelligence to date have not been in direct replacement, but have been in changes of like the kind, changes of a qualitative shift rather than quantitative shift. And so, kind of what I mean by this is, think about, for example, advertising, right? That, you know, kind of before the internet, you know, if you wanted to advertise, you would go and like pick a TV program that you think might appeal to, you know, your particular demographic. Now you can go to Google or Facebook, Twitter, and you can have this very finely diced thing that relies on machine learning to be able to target very well. And it's not like this wasn't a direct replacement of activities that humans were doing. This is just a totally new activity that wasn't possible before. And so I think that we're going to see a decent amount of this, where suddenly there are new opportunities and new systems and new capabilities that it was just too fine-grained, too expensive for humans to do at all. And, you know, going to require some human operators, right? That you still need to have an expert on the other end who's tuning your Facebook and Twitter marketing spend. And so I think that there's some optimism on the perspective of the best improvements, I think, are not going to be direct replacement. I think the best improvements are going to be an improvement in the kind of work that can be done. That being said, you know, I think it'd be very naive to say, oh, well, it's all going to be great, and it's just we're just going to introduce these other things. There's no question that there's going to be quite a lot of upheaval, and I think that you can't hope to introduce self-driving cars and trucks into a society that has such a large percentage of people in the transportation industry without expecting there to be some sort of large effect. And And I do think that ultimately this is something that, I mean, this is to some extent, you know, what the government is here for, right, is to help with these sorts of things and to, and, you know, I think one thing that's going to be hard is it's going to be fast, right? And I think that this particular transition is one where there is a lot of dollars incentivizing this transition happening. And I think that there's a lot of also safety and humanitarian reasons. You know, I think it's if we have self-driving cars that are 10 times safer than human drivers, there's no question that I want people to be to have self-driving cars.
Yeah.
And so I think it's going to be, I think it's going to be tough. I don't think it's going to be easy, right? I think that being able to keep up with the rate of change for the government is going to be difficult. And so I think that actually here's another place where, so YC Research is one of the sponsors of OpenAI, and you know, we sort of are very involved with them. And one of the other projects that they've kicked off is a basic income project where they're trying to research the effect of basic income, which is the idea of what if you just give everyone a fixed income and so then they can go and spend it however they want, you know, what do they do, right? Is it, you know, are people happier? Do they just spend their time playing video games? Do they go and do interesting artistic pursuits? Like, what happens, right? I think right now, we don't know. And I think that basic income seems like the best long-term solution that anyone's proposed. Like, maybe there's something better, but I'm not aware of it. And I think that it's going to be important for we, you know, both sort of people within the technology community and more narrowly the AI community, but also more broadly, just society, I think, need to be involved in this debate, in this question, and thinking about the what's going to happen as these technologies unfold. And I think that it's tough because, you know, one thing that I think AI has suffered from in the past is sort of these hype cycles, right? That there have been in the 60s and again in the 80s, these techniques that people got very excited about, these times where people, and actually really is about specifically neural networks, that people thought, oh, this is going to solve everything. And then it didn't solve everything. And it turned out that the techniques were weaker in particular ways. But then, you know, later on people came and got excited about them again because they realized you could look at it in a slightly different way or apply a different algorithm. And I think there's something that's different today, right? And I know that every single time someone says it's different. But I think that this particular time, that these techniques are starting to become the domain of companies, right? That now it's very clear that if you apply a bunch of dollars researching, you know, problem X, you can get a great ROI on it, right? You know, it's a very clear business proposition to a company like Google that this is something that they can just invest in, and they're going to get a lot more money out of it. And so that I think that it's not a question of hype at that point, right? It's just a question of ROI, mm-hmm. And so I think that. That we're not really in danger right now of the same sort of boom bust. I think that there's other kinds of boom bust that you might worry about, and I think it's still important to be very careful and to be very cognizant of what really works, what do we really have, rather than just saying, oh, this is going to solve everything, and you know we're to this, you know, human level AI already, because I don't think that's where we are. But I think basically it's just important for us to have a public and just level-headed debate and conversation about here's where we are, here's where we think we're going, here's where we hope we're going, and then try to figure out how we all steer this collectively to the best possible outcome.
Yeah. Well, Greg Brockman, thank you for joining me on the Forum on World Class IT. It's been a great conversation.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategies' five principles of world class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.